And we can also say that Michelle Monroe, I think, has left Melbourne, Australia, and continues on her world tour. She'll be back live with us again in a whole range of things, with another selection, of course, from her father Matt Monroe's wonderful catalogue. He might have left his heart in San Francisco, as the Tony Bennett classic went, but somebody who's currently over again on the West Coast of America, about to make her debut on the Midweek Drive, is a young lady who's an award-winning BBC correspondent, recently edited Redefining Black Power, Reflections on the State of Black America, as in a whole range of extensive interviews across America, is a regular for those folk who appreciate the joys of Up All Night, when she connects with a whole heap of other goodies from the fabulous archive of Pacifica Radio and so on and so forth. Yes, we are talking of somebody who is about to achieve legendary status, if she isn't indeed already legendary. Joanne Griffith, are you indeed there?
I am a legendary status. Oh my goodness, I've been called a lot of things in life, but a legend is new. Listen, so thank you very much for that.
Joanne, I've often thought that that dot in Adebayo, he doesn't give you the credit you deserve, and I think it's important that he sort of goes through that. It's crucial. You know,
I've known Dot for a long time, so it's a lot of friendly banter.
Yeah, well, it may well be, but there are times that those of us who actually leave Teesside about 4 a.m. on a Monday morning to drive down to Lincoln, and I'm thinking, oi, Dotton, stop it now. Oi, that's enough, you know? You could pass that on.
You may have to start a letter-writing campaign, well, writing to him and tell him to be nicer to Joe on a Sunday night. I'd appreciate that.
You see, this is it, Joanne, and I also have to say how wonderfully retro to say a letter-writing campaign in these days of hyper-technology, etc.
I know.
Genius. We also have to say that Barney Chandry sends his very best. So I've just done that live on air.
Thank you, Barney.
Marvellous. That's great, great stuff there. Let's go to our ace third year level 3 journalist and investigative reporter, Natalie Tuck. Natalie, Redefining Black Power, Reflections on the State of Black America, from, of course, the website www.redefiningblackpower.com. Any questions you'd like to put to Joanne?
How did you develop an interest in basically black people in America?
Well, I'm black myself. My parents are actually from the Caribbean, from Barbados. I grew up in a little town of Luton, Luton Airport, back in the 80s and 90s. And really my interest sprung from my own family experiences. Growing up, I was one of very few black kids in my school. And my parents are very good at making sure that I knew a lot about, the culture of Barbados and also what it meant to be black living in this global community. That really then fed into a lot of things that I did as a journalist. I actually started out at BBC Three Counties down in Luton and started out actually volunteering on the African Caribbean program called Black Mix that used to go out on the weekends. And so that really got me into, what was happening locally in Beds, Tarts and Bucks. That then fed into the work I did at the Community Affairs Unit, the work I did with diversity at BBC London. So it's kind of been a theme pretty much throughout my life. When I went to university, I was lucky enough to spend a semester at the university in Arizona. And there I did a dissertation that was looking at the right-wing militia movement and racism. It was a little bit heavy, I have to say, but again, an interesting insight into a very interesting political movement here in the United States. And so, yeah, I've pretty much spent my whole career in some way, shape, or form telling stories from throughout the African diaspora, whether it be in the UK, Europe, the Caribbean, Africa, or the United States, where I am now. So it's been a long road, but I never thought that I would write a book. It was never my intention to write a book, but here we are, and I'm very glad that I did it in the end.
It's certainly something which, in terms of looking at the profile, and hopefully, as I say, we're getting hold of a copy in all sorts of ways to actually sort of access it. But in an era where we still tend to think that actually racism, it's a thing of the past, it's the last century. We were actually doing a review of a book by Andrea Levy, which you may have actually encountered, Joanne, called Small Island, which kind of addresses these issues. And we still seem to have a situation, and it'd be interesting if you found this in your research in America, whereby, although ostensibly there are legal aspects to prevent any of the sort of isms coming through on this particular area, people still get judged simply on the basis of the colour of their skin, whether it's Chinese, whether it's Asian, whether it's Eurasian, whether black, etc. Is that something which you found is still the case in America today?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And one of the people that I speak to for the book, and the book is actually a series of conversations that have been transcribed, and I wrote introductions for each chapter. But one conversation I had was with economist Dr. Julianne Malveaux, and she said, you know, after the election there was this buzzword of, oh, we're living in a post-racial society. America has a black president who is now post-racial. And she was like, what absolute nonsense that we can say that a country, you know, that history is steeped and based on the oppression of another, a person of colour, can now all of a sudden the slate can be wiped clean and, you know, we'll have this big kumbaya moment and everything will be great and lovely. I said, no, you know, America is not post-racial. There are still deep issues, even with, you know, legal statutes in place, things like affirmative action and so on, that just doesn't happen. I'm sure that you've been reporting or hearing about it in the UK of the case of the 17-year-old black teenager Trayvon Martin, who was shot dead 3 weeks ago by a neighbourhood watch captain, who is mixed race himself, he's white and Hispanic. But everyone was trying to say in the news media, well, this, you know, this is not a racial case. It's now transpired that in a 911, or as we call it, 999, phone call to police, that George Zimmerman, the man that shot Trayvon Martin, he, you know, called him a racial slur. So all of a sudden, it's like, well, this kid who was unarmed, who had literally gone to the store to buy a can of iced tea and a bag of Skittles, was walking back to his own father's house, was shot dead primarily because of the color of his skin. And so when you hear of cases like that and so many others around the United States, it's a real stark and horrible reminder that, no, racism is still very much alive and well and living here in the U.S. So, you know, and that's for people of all colors. We're not even talking about African-American. It's people across the board that there are real problems and issues. And I'd even go so far to say that, to be honest, having an African-American president is in some ways actually made it worse.
That's a very depressing sort of moment, actually, I think, to share with us, really. I mean, I think there's sort of various glum faces in the co-presentation. Let's turn to Jericho first and foremost. I mean, Jericho, your thoughts on this area?
Well, I just like, well, there's two sides of it. I'm not racist at all, but I get struggled. What do you say now because of political correctness and that? I don't have a clue what to say. So.
Would you shed some light
on that?
Well, I mean, I don't know. We're sort of working through that. I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, the line "political correctness gone mad" I think is insane in many ways. Well, it would be really. It's tautology. But in terms of that, I would have loved to have actually thought that actually we don't need to legislate. But the more one thinks about the whole thing, actually, maybe you do need that legislation in place to actually just check folk when they do find themselves slipping into a scenario without, you know, getting into real thinking and right thinking and wrong thinking, etc. But ultimately, you know, surely we need to have matured as a human race, as a human species, to actually acknowledge that, you know, it's irrelevant. I mean, I think, you know, recently in Britain we've had the almost tragic case, thankfully it looks as though it's taking a turn for the better now, of obviously Fabrice Muamba. And it was actually very refreshing to actually find the number of folk who actually were very supportive. And it was just as somebody who was a young footballer, a young man who'd had a heart attack. And it was interesting, again, from the religious perspective, the number of times people have been praying for Fabrice Muamba, which is another sort of line of things. But there was that kind of sense of uniformity. I go back to the inspirational words of Martin Luther King. I listen to some of the things that we talked about, Pacifica Radio, some of those key essences. That, you know, one tends to think, do we repeat the same mistakes? Is it a case of the old classic notion of we are repeating the mistakes of our ancestors and simply going down the same path? And are we kind of just a smidgen away from actually saying, right, it's time to actually go down a sort of prejudiced route, etc., and go back to almost an apartheid situation?
I think it's a case, so to answer an earlier point that you made about legislation, it's like everything, it's about balance, and you can have legislation, you can have laws in place, but it's kind of down to people whether they decide to, A, follow those rules and those regulations, and B, about how those rules and regulations are actually policed and put into effect. You know, it is depressing, and, you know, it's not a happy thing to talk about it, but I think we ignore these issues regardless of where we are. We regard we ignore these issues at our peril. I do think, however, that there is a way that perhaps things are not as grim as they once were. You will always find that until we really begin to understand it, that these issues will come up again and again and again and again. One of the gentlemen that I spoke to in the book, and he's actually the first chapter, Dr. Vincent Harding, he was actually a speechwriter for Dr. King. And he made the point, he's in his 80s now, I think he's like 82 or 83, and he made the point that when he was working in the movement in the 50s and 60s and 70s, that it was never about electing a black president. It was not even necessarily about securing rights just for black people. It was always about human rights, because he said, you know, if black people are doing okay, but then Latinos and Asian people aren't, then we have not succeeded. So it's really about bettering ourselves as a human race. And evolution is a funny thing. You move forward 10 steps, you maybe slip back 5. You maybe move forward another 10, you maybe slip back 3. And I think that's the cycle that we are in now. So we can't go as far as making everything about political correctness, because we've tried that and that doesn't work. But we do have to perhaps learn from the lessons and the mistakes that have been made in the past and try to do better. And with this case here in the US with Trayvon Martin, you're really seeing that people are trying, regardless of race, to do the right thing, putting pressure on the local police department, putting pressure on Florida's attorney general. And I'm confident that that justice will be served in this case, and I'm hopeful that it won't take as long as perhaps it's taken in other cases, and that's because collectively people want to do better.
It's a fascinating scenario. I think back, obviously, in the last century, the Rodney King case, and this whole question of the horrendous scenario, and obviously the riots that subsequently ensued from that issue. At the same time, we spent a lot of time on the show today talking with Julia Rodriguez-Elliott, who's a Latino producing artistic director of the Pasadena Repertory Company and Noise Within, focusing on the classics, the Shakespearean set. We're going in a few moments to Phil Leonis in Los Angeles. I'm thinking Gene Roddenberry with his multiculturalism with respect to Star Trek is very much sort of at the fore of this. Is it almost a case of a drip-by-drip approach? And I know that there are certain folks who say, what do we need to sort of ensure we have tokenism, we have the token X, Y, Z person, etc. in the, is it a case of the mass media, and I'm thinking Hollywood as well as the film industry, can also start resetting the boundaries here? I mean, you know, one goes back probably way before your time, Joanne, to I Spy, the first kind of classic series, popular series with Robert Culp and Bill Cosby, a black lead actor in a lead heroic role as opposed to kind of cliche role. Is it a case of you need to almost sit, and I'm not talking positive discrimination after a fashion, but actually you're looking at ensuring that people are acknowledged as being people first and the colour of the skin is second from that point of view, or are we always going to sort of have to make the judgment on the basis of a non-colourblind society?
I think it's always a judgment call, but I think what you said first off was right, that it really is a drip-by-drip approach, and it's across the board. It's within media. I mean, obviously the images that we see coming out of Hollywood are so powerful, both to the positive and to the negative. Certainly being here, you see a really positive reaction. And I remember it growing up. You know, one of the first programs that I saw with an all-black cast was a program called No Problem that used to air on BBC Two, I think, on like a Friday night at 9 o'clock or something. But it was a big deal, because I remember all of us as a family sitting around the television, we were like the black people on the television. This was in the 80s.
Unbelievable, you know.
Totally unbelievable, but it's true. Unfortunately, though, there is still that reaction that when there is, a black film that is good, or, you know, as we saw this year with the film Help, people were really divided, because they were so happy that a film with a predominantly black cast would be nominated for Oscars, you know, Best Actress for Viola Davis and Best Supporting Actress for Octavia Butler. And people were like, oh my gosh, this is fantastic. But yet they were really concerned because of the content of the film being about, maids in, the Jim Crow South in the 1950s. So people were very divided about that. So it is about the images that are put out in the mass media, but it is also about, you know, just what's going on ordinarily in everyday life, in our education system, in our healthcare systems, in our, in our schools and our universities. because, you know, not everyone is a Hollywood star. Not everyone necessarily taps into what's going on, you know, what's going on in the media. But something one of the contributors to the book said, Esther Amar, we had this conversation about what she calls emotional justice and how black people around the world feel about themselves. And she said, you know, with Barack Obama and any other black person that we see, we should never discount the meaning and the power of symbolism. And although you don't want to just... I completely disagree with putting people in jobs that they're not qualified for, regardless of race.
I think we are all, in most cases, agreed with that. I mean, if you're incompetent, you're incompetent, etc., but at the same time...
Right. And it doesn't help. If you're putting someone in a position just because of their colour and they're no good, it causes more harm than good, which I've witnessed it. Mm. But, you know, you've got to go out and find the people who are good at the job and put them in the position that they deserve. I don't think that's political correctness. I think in this day and age, it's actually good business sense.
I'm reminded, Joanne, of the question mark that Nichelle Nichols actually had when she had a conversation with Martin Luther King, and she was going to quit the Star Trek series after the first series because she felt, I'm not really being used for anything here other than effectively saying hailing frequencies open. And it was Martin Luther King who said, again, exactly that, the power of the symbol, the fact that you could actually look forward to the 23rd century and actually have a black woman in a command policy, albeit communications and so on, was actually a really significant point. And that was one of the reasons she stayed there, leading, obviously, to Whoopi Goldberg and a whole heap of other folk sort of connected within that. We've been joined in the studio by Joy Knight, who's the Faculty Officer for Humanities here. We like to feel it's humanities in all sorts of ways here. Joy, you've been having a listen to Joanne.
Yeah, very fun.
Thoughts and comments?
Well, very interesting and so personal, I think. You know, I mean, obviously, you know, with race... It's a real issue in Hollywood, as well as gender, I think. You know, I get very fed up of seeing women in very stereotypical roles and feel that, as a woman, my position is being excluded from film. So, you know, I think the two points really clearly overlap, and you know, it is an issue that needs addressing and given more consideration.
Although it has to be said that, let's face it, Natalie would have had to have therapy if Meryl Streep had lost the Oscar to Viola Davis. I mean, I think it's fair to say. I know you were pushing all the way for Meryl, Natalie, and what if Viola had won? You would have been a little bit sad, wouldn't you? Really,
it would have been a little bit sad, but yeah. If she had lost to Viola, it would have been okay. But if she had lost to any of the other contenders, I would have been devastated.
Mm. See, there you have it. You see, the word, Joanne, of a Meryl Streep aficionado there. You know, carried writ large, you know, all sorts of things. Tiffany, questions for yourself.
About all the interviews you've been doing, I was just wondering, was everyone happy to speak to all the interviewees, or was there any problems with that?
No, I mean, they agreed to do it, so...
It's Joanne Griffith, what's not to love? You know, that's the bottom line. Oh.
Have you got any interesting stories?
You know...
You don't have to reveal the names, Joanne. You can actually sort of say, you know, the names have been changed to protect the innocent, but, you know...
No, they were all absolutely fantastic interviewees who really gave a lot of their time. I think the one interview that surprised me the most was the first one that I did with Sir Vincent Harding. You know, I'd interviewed him before for my show on Five Live, and he was like at the top of my list of people that I wanted to interview for the book. And you know, as a journalist, you read and you prepare and you have all your notes and your questions and all of those kind of things. And I think I asked one question from my list, and he just took me in a completely different direction, where he was talking about what he described as the movement for the deepening and expansion of democracy in America. And he said, you know, for him, the movement was always about more than civil rights. It was always about this movement for the deepening and expansion of democracy in America. And it really set the tone for the whole book. I thought I was going to write a very different book, but just because of that one conversation that I had with Vincent Harding, and also found out that his family heritage is from Barbados as well, which always touches me because it's such a small island and there's so few of us that it's nice to meet other people from Barbados. So it was to be in contact in such close proximity with someone who, you know, was a dear friend of Dr. Martin Luther King, who is so humble and who is still in his 80s doing the work. it just made me realise that, you know, the stuff that I do is really just scratching the surface, and, you know, there's so much more to it than just sitting down and talking with people. I probably learned more than I actually put out, if that makes sense. It was a career-changing project.
The text, once again, it's called Redefining Black Power. You can find out details by going to www.redefiningblackpower.com. Katie, any sort of comments that you've got to sort of raise with Joanna? It has to be pointed out as well that if you do go to the Small Island Review of the Book of the Month, I'm afraid that because I couldn't actually find any Jamaican citizens, I do actually do an attempt at a Jamaican accent one, but I better not go any further with it. No, just stop it. Stop it now.
No, yeah, please.
Exactly. Anyway, Katie.
I actually really find civil rights movement interesting, because obviously I do American studies, and it's one of my favourite things to do.
Which is encouraging, because it means that our next generation, Joanne, are still keeping their finger on the pulse when it comes around to that. The fact that they've...
Yes. And in a way, that's kind of what this book and this whole wider project is about. You know, we have this book, all 200 pages of it, but, you know, the reason why the website is a bit not just to kind of look glossy and for people to be able to buy the book, but it's also about continuing the conversation, so people can actually submit blog posts and videos and little audio entries talking about, you know, things that are concerning them within their communities as it pertains to race, because, you know, as we've said throughout this whole conversation, it is hard to talk about race. It is hard to know what to do for the best. So through the website, I'm really hoping that we can continue the conversation. I've been touring around the United States over February, and I'll be doing it again in May, talking with different communities about what race means to them. And I'd love to hear from some more people from the UK as well, especially, you know, kind of young folks there who are studying. But yeah, we need to know about our history, regardless of what race we are, so that we can even begin to make things better in the future. It's, you know, there's a lot of work to be done.
Joanne, it's been splendid, and indeed, dare I say, it's a touch inspiring to actually share some airtime with your good self today, which is good material from that point of view. Interesting, looking at the website, we have obviously the projects, the contributors, authors, bio events, etc. Well worth going to, redefining blackpower.com. Wonderful stuff from that point of view. Joy, would you like to throw those last two questions at Joanne Griffith, please?
I would. Joanne, have you had a reasonably interesting conversation with us this evening?
Oh, yes. Yeah. It's always nice speaking to people that sound like me. It's lovely.
Well, you see, look, Joanne, bottom line, you're over there to actually win back the colonies. You're part of a strategy that we're adopting to actually put, you know, key British people into key parts of the whole thing. And subtly, slowly but surely...
everybody.
Exactly.
Joanne, can we look forward to speaking with you again in the near future?
Oh, absolutely. I'd love to come back, and I'm really hoping that I'll actually be able to make it, you know, back to UK shores and speak at some universities and some colleges and, you know, continue this conversation in the UK, because even though this book is, you know, focused on race and issues surrounding Obama here in the United States, you know, this is a conversation that continues in the UK. So
yeah, definitely.
If anyone wants to invite me over to come and chat with you in person, I would love to come.
I think we can actually work on that,
yeah,
in all sorts of ways.
Good. So
carry on regardless. Joanne Griffith, award-winning BBC correspondent. By the way, what was the award for?
It was a Sony Award.
There we are, of course, you know, inevitably. Yes, so, you know, so, from award-winning BBC correspondent to award-winning radio station. Splendid stuff, Joanne. Take care, and we will speak to you again very, very soon.
Will do. Thank you, Alex.
Destination now.